This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that should have stayed home to play some FIFA. This is the movie Daenerys, and due to the alien invasion, the usual gang is holed up somewhere, so I had to call for reinforcements.
Hi, I'm Michelle Ely, and I'm hiding out here in my own little weed room.
So does that make it Michelle's weed room?
Yes, Michelle's weed room, and...
So it's a room full of weed, and it's owned by Michelle, right?
Yes, and then there's a little, you know, guy playing saxophone, because I just feel like it.
Works for me. In this episode, we're discussing Attack the Block, starring John Boyega, Jodie Whittaker, Alex Ismail, Leon James, Franz Drame, and Nick Frost, directed by Joe Cornish. So... we are about to enter October, which for Art House Legends, we become Art House of Horror. But we're not there just yet. But I felt like this movie really should be in the roster because, well, it's an awesome science fiction horror film, which I found a few years back. And it's something that I've been really supportive of since I've seen it. And, well, it has two pretty big geek names out there right now, which I have a feeling we'll be talking about a little bit more as we get into the geek sheet. But out of curiosity, how did you come aware of this particular movie? Was this during the initial theatrical run, or did it come to your attention later?
Much later. I ended up finding it DVD. You know, it's one of those things where it was word of mouth, and have you seen this? Have you seen this? You should see it. So I ended up watching it and enjoyed every minute of it.
So this film came out of Fantastic Fest, which is a film festival that's kind of on the nerdier side. In fact, this is the same film festival that gave us other gems like The Descent and Paranormal Activity. A lot of the kind of cult films that run in, especially in the nerd circles, pretty much come from Fantastic Fest or has made a splash at Fantastic Fest. Also, on top of that, I also became aware of this because of Ain't It Cool News, which also is like, oh, you got to see this movie. You got to see this movie. This is like one of the most awesomest things to ever happen. And so I actually sought this movie out when it was in theaters. I had to go halfway across Houston to find it. And it was one of those movies that after I came out of it, I got onto every social media site I can. It's like, you got to see this movie. You got to see this movie. And I had a hard time getting people to see this movie. And then, of course, you know, one of the actors kind of became big in Star Wars. And then by that point, everyone was like, okay, I guess I'll give it a shot. Now here we are. But so knowing that about this particular film, what do you think is are things that kind of that attracted audiences to it that you see? Where do you think that this film kind of captured the imagination of especially genre filmgoers?
Well, it has like that visceral sort of like it could happen to me feeling, because it's not on some sort of, this isn't an alien invasion. That's not some big grand scale where you've got like Will Smith and you got a great speech by a president. This is just, you know, some, you know, regular
ground
block.
Level.
Yeah. You know, this is a forgotten part of London. In the States, we would basically call it the projects. You know, it's that poor part of the neighborhood that, you know, it's the Compton, it's the Watts, it's, you know, it's forgotten even by like the police and such. And I think that's one of the things. It's like one of those, like, it could happen to me. And hey, I've been a teenager and here are these kids who are, you know, they're just kids. They're, they're not that great of kids. They could be worse. They could be a lot better. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that whole, like, how that whole, like, John Carpenter, like, Mist, or, you know, The Thing, or like Fog, and just mm-hmm. things like that, you know, just very sort of their neighborhood, like the, like Halloween was, you know, here's my babysitter, and oh my goodness, just, I think it resonated on that level.
It's funny that you say that, because especially when I first saw this film in theaters, John Carpenter came heavy into mind. But as I've watched this film probably like 6 or 7 times now, I won't lie, this is a film that I've held strong emotional feelings for. I've also noticed a lot of other 80s throwbacks to this movie. And one that I'm surprised it only took me more recently to find, The Goonies. Played a kind of had a vibe to this particular movie as well, considering that in that particular film we had some kids that weren't exactly the best kids in the world. They were definitely very memorable and some of them were very charming, but you also had some assholes and some less than likable characters in that group. And here you have, again, I think it's very interesting that the first thing that we see our protagonists do is mug someone. Not exactly like extremely violently, but very disconcerting, especially considering that these are going to be our heroes and that the film is going to kind of treat them as heroes. But what did you think about that opening scene in the film?
Yeah, that was, it was uncomfortable. I mean, I believe everybody has the right to walk safely to and from places, whether it's 3 p.m. or 3 a.m., and I am a woman, and I had that talk from my mom about, like, this is how you use your keys to defend yourself and all that type of stuff. So that part of me where it was like, girl, why are you walking like that? Don't you know any better? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, that's a wrong response we should have. Everyone should feel safe. But yeah, I mean, they come off as very, threatening because of the fact that it is a group of them. They do surround her, and they have like their scarves on and stuff like that. So you can tell that they're like prepared, but then again, you see them on bikes and mm-hmm. it's like, and only one of them has a small little knife. And it's like, I'm wondering if these kids are just, it's one of those, like they're playing a part in order to just get by another day. It's like, I don't, you know, obviously I don't like them right from the beginning, and they're not. And watching it again, though, I can understand, you know, kind of why they did it this way. But it is a very bold approach to, here are your heroes. They start off as world-class jerks.
Yeah. And actually, it's one of those things that is both disconcerting, but at the same time, when you look at it through the whole prism of what the film is going to do and what these characters are going to have to go through, I find it very interesting that it does start like this, because the first two acts, first they mug someone and then they chase and kill a creature. I mean, let's put it, I mean, in the film, it is an alien that they kill, but let's just put it this way. If this were, let's say, a dog or a cat, we would definitely not feel very friendly towards these kids, especially considering they're dragging around, they're making jokes, they're joking about this, right? That's a very, and I find it very interesting that the film is willing to tell you, okay, these characters are, I don't want to say bad, because bad is, and I think this is a film that really wants to make you question good and bad. And I think that that's kind of one of the elements that this film is going for specifically, and especially considering that all the different kids, they're all different. And when you mention that they kind of, they're playing the roles, I find it very interesting, like when we see them at their homes, you know, when they're going to grab the weapons, you know, they have the, like the knife and they had like some bats and stuff. But when they go out for war, you know, out come the machetes. This is when they get the katana swords and stuff like that. So they're not even bringing their most intimidating weapons to mugging. If it comes to actual out and out combat, they actually have weapons for that. That's not what they're taking to these little muggings. But at the same time, though, their households are different. When we go to each and every character's homes, Some of them have parents. Some of them have what looks like very stable homes, you know, from the 4 or 5 seconds that we see. You know, we have parents that are like, oh, no, you're going to take your dog out for a walk, which, of course, sets up a thing that will happen later on. But, you know, it's like, so you, and they're all from very different backgrounds, even if they're in from the same block or the same apartment complex. Right. So I find that very fascinating here. But at the first, we really don't know what to make of them. We don't know where this movie is going to be going. Right. Other than they are willing to carry on an alien in the back, in their backpack. Right.
Yeah. Because, you know, and it's interesting that this is the generation that, they've always known video games. They've always known microwaves and probably the internet, or they were, you know, born just as like the internet was starting and such. So it's kind of weird because that's a generation that's removed from me. And so for them to like, they knew it wasn't a cat or a dog. So like they knew that much and they knew it was something kind of weird. And so then to go in first instinct to kill it, that again sort of like, you know, goes up against. But what's interesting is like when they start showing people and trying to tell people, everyone's just like, like, why would aliens be here? That looks like a creature. That looks like a puppet. Hey, did you make that?
And well, it does look like a puppet.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of interesting about like how long it takes, like even their friends to believe them. I mean, it's one of those things like we see in horror movies where strangers have to try to convince each other and that's a natural obstacle. But here, you know, like they have friends that are in the same building and they're like, nah, I don't think that. No. And
The thing is that puppetry and this kind of stuff, especially cause that creature does look like a puppet. And I think that's both a testament to the writing for the film and also the fact that, you could probably make a puppet out of something like that. So I also love that the film kind of sets it up so that no one really trusts these kids. I mean, yeah, they go around, they're acting like a gang, kind of, you know, not like a hardcore gang, but kind of like a Goonies gang. So much to say, you know, they're mostly just going out and getting into trouble. Nothing too terribly serious, although they are starting to get into that place where they could seriously get into even more serious trouble, as we'll see not too much longer into the film. They're in that transition where they could actually become more, you know, more hardcore. They're just not there yet. And so, yeah, when they're seeing them dragging around this creature thing, I could definitely see them not taking it very seriously right from the beginning because, you know, there's nothing that says serious about this group at all. But at the same time, though, it's like when they do take it up to Nick Frost's place, and you know, he's the one who takes them seriously, right? He's the one that's willing to, even though he, he doesn't like find. It's like he'll accept that the fact that they killed something. Like, okay, that's fine, whatever. And of course, he's so sound of his mind that they could say that they, you know, took out Bugs Bunny, and he'd probably believe him for that too. But at the same time, though, he does kind of respect them in that sense. He takes them for the word, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But it's like, yeah, I'll let you in. Maybe that's an alien or whatever, but you have to actually talk to my boss. And that was what's interesting is that, you know, here's Nick Frost and his character isn't even the boss. You have to ask Hi-Hats, who's in the weed room. And I thought that was very interesting that like Nick Frost wasn't like the guy in charge.
I actually like that a lot because quite honestly, especially in this, one thing that I absolutely love about this film is that it sets up geography. And anyone who listens to the podcast knows, I love it when a film structures itself in a way that you know where everything is, not just in like terms of actual locations, but where characters kind of connect with one another. And in the sense of Nick Frost's character, yeah, he's the guy who has the room, but at the same time, though, he's not he's not the guy. He's not the one in charge. So, you know, you need to have someone above him. And on top of that, we also need kind of another threat besides the alien. You know, someone that is more grounded, someone that we could probably see being more of a threat to these kids than the alien is, right? And I think that that's what kind of sets that character up so well.
Yeah, because that is, you know, that moment where, you know, Hi-Hats gives Moses basically harder drugs to go sell. And, you know, it's that moment to where, you know, like, I don't have that experience in my life, but I've watched things like The Wire and things like that. And I'm not saying those are documentaries, but, mm-hmm. you know, you hear about like these kids feeling like they don't have a lot of choices. And that's one of the things about these characters. They feel like they don't have a lot of choices. And so here, you know, Moses and even his friends are like, oh, my goodness, you're being recognized by Hi-Hats. You know, this is, mm-hmm. you know, a moment for you. And it's very interesting that this alien threat also comes along and he has to, you know, make this decision about what type of leader of this group he's going to be.
Well, that's the thing that I find very interesting, because the Goonies themselves aren't working with Hi-Hats. Hi-Hats isn't recognizing them. He's recognizing Moses. And we'll be getting into Moses more specifically in just a little bit, because I'll be honest here, this is possibly one of the most complex characters in the film. And especially when we talk about John Boyega as an actor, because this was my first time seeing him in a film. And this is, I mean, after I saw this film, I really wanted to know what he was going to do next. Of course, there was no way to know 5 years ago, or actually 6 years ago, that he would be a part of the world's biggest franchise of all time and, you know, and grow from there. But the Goonies gang that he's with is kind of his child. This is, again, kind of a transition from childhood to adulthood. What Hi-Hats does is he is basically setting up Moses to move on to becoming a more dangerous person. This is the adulthood kind of breaking in. This is a last chance. In fact, if you want to say it, this alien invasion maybe saved Moses from a more disastrous life. I mean, especially considering what will happen literally as soon as they get out the door. You know, he's arrested. He's being tossed by the police, not because of the aliens, but because of his activities, because the fact that he had those drugs on him only made it worse for him, right?
Yes.
So, and that's one of the things that I think this movie does very interesting, is that it wants you to have fun with the alien aspects, but it also doesn't want you to ignore the fact this is a bad neighborhood, and the lives that these kids are living is precarious at best. You know, this is the wrong side of London. This is the part that you're not going to see, you know, done on Doctor Who. This is the part of London that is, you know, that is the needing of more attention, that is going to breed the most crime, in that town. And it wants to kind of put a spotlight on it while at the same time having fun with, you know, all of these monstrous aliens kind of attacking, right? And kind of setting that as a location for this alien invasion. Do you see that, or do you see something else?
Oh, no, I see that as well. And, you know, I like the fact that his name is Moses, because of the whole connotation of, you know, leading people, either, you know, because of the, you know, let my people go, leading them across the desert, across the sea, parting the sea and such. I thought Moses was a great name for him. And mm-hmm. you know, he's not a complete bad guy, because even when he's being arrested, first off, he doesn't rat his friends out, yeah. And such, but he also tries to warn the police that a creature is coming, that, you know, something bad's happening and stuff. The police, of course, are ignoring him, which is why he's like, put me in the van.
It was like, please, you know, just get me out of that, get me off the street.
Yeah.
But another thing I have to mention before we get further into this, one thing that I really love about what Joe Cornish does with the story here is that the reason why the aliens attack the way that they do is all goes back to what Moses has done. Moses is responsible for a lot of what happens because he drug that alien everywhere. And then one thing I noticed on my most recent playthrough is he drug the thing where it was touching the ground. So he left a literal trail for those aliens everywhere he goes. Every person he met, those are the ones that the creatures attacked, right? That's an interesting little piece of information that on the second watch that you would notice, because especially when we find out about the whole pheromone thing, which was also set up on that TV documentary that we saw.
Yes.
You know, back at the at Ron's apartment.
Yes.
It's like it does a very good job of setting up things that'll be explained later on, and that you'll kind of get on a second and third watch. But again, though, it's very fascinating how this is all set up in that first act. And on top of that, because they are going back to the block, we're also getting that geography so that we can set up the those steps, and we can set up that garage. We can set up the floors on the block, the ones that are going to be important, you know, as we get into the story. You know, in fact, I think they even set up the dumpster in one scene. If I'm not correct, that's where they meet Mayhem and Props, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, what would you think of Mayhem and Props? I mean, that's got to be both cute and very troubling.
It is, because it shows that the situation there is a cycle. That's one of the things when you examine poverty and the cycle of poverty and how the system can actually create a situation to where your parents can't get out, and because the parents can't get out, you can't get out, and the next generation probably can't get out. And that's what's really sad for me when I see those little kids. It's like, you know, just how many, you know, generations have lived in that block who couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm. But also, I do find that very troubling. But at the same time, though, it's because they do look up to this group, right? And in a way, this group is very protective of these two, right? They don't want to see them getting in trouble. They don't want to see them, you know, getting themselves hurt. And at the same time, though, these two really want the respect of this group, right? Of our Goonies gang. And, you know, the fact that they're setting up, you know, they get the super soaker and the cap gun. I love the line. It's like, what are you going to do? Splash water on us? Like, that ain't water in that super soaker. I love the little setups that the film does, even with the little cap gun, which we'll get back into when we get to another aspect that I find very fascinating about the film in just a little bit. But at the same time, though, these two are kind of a bit of extra comic relief. They also kind of help set up an aspect that we'll get later on with one of the group being, you know, trapped. And they do kind of come through. So I don't know. I think that's one of the things that the film is doing, is it wants you to kind of, yeah, you want to enjoy it and you know, kind of laugh. But it's also trying to say, this is really fucked up. You know, this is, you know, we're taking something real. We're going to make it fun, but we're also not going to make you forget. Without the aliens, this would be a very different movie. You know, and I think that's very interesting in that aspect. But do you see that, or is it just pure horror?
Yeah. Like this, if it wasn't for like the aliens, it would be like an, you know, like Boys in the Hood or like an episode of The Wire or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the alien part of it, you know, does move it into that horror sci-fi. And, you know, I love that you're bringing up the Goonies, because one of the things I wrote in my notes, I realized that an audience who would watch it now would probably go, oh, my goodness, they're like that gang from Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when they're on their bikes and everything.
Yeah.
And especially now that we've had a particular film about an evil killer clown that basically skyrocketed to unheard of success. You know, it's very interesting, you know, this kind of, you know, the sway towards kind of the 80s elements here. And the kind of that 80s mentality, because this film really does feel 80s. I mean, if you, you know, take away the you know, the cell phones and stuff. I mean, if they set this in like 1985, you'd probably feel about the same, right?
Yeah, because I love the fact that they have the cheap cell phones. They have, they talk about like the credits, you know, that's, mm-hmm. you know, very,
I've had
prepaid
cell phones. I know how that works.
Yeah. And it's like, if this was in the 80s, they would have cheap walkie talkies, you know, mm-hmm. like they would have those things. And, you know, you're right, considering just how, that these guys are poor, they're broke, so they can't afford all these nice, wonderful things. So yeah, you could just easily swap out the cell phones, put in some walkie talkies, and you would pretty much have the almost like the same movie.
That's true. But at the same time, though, so when the aliens really start to ratchet up, and I love exactly how they set that up as well, because after they kill the first alien, you know, we have that pan up to the sky, and then we have the zoom in. And we see that more of those kind of comet-like things that we saw with the first creature were coming down. So that sets up the threat. It's like, it's not just this one. We're going to get a whole lot more. And especially considering that they set up also that this first one was kind of a female, which, you know, say what you will about the kind of the dynamics of sexes, of the sexes of these creatures. You know, that first one isn't going to be as dangerous, but when you have males, especially, well, we'll just say it, horny males, yeah, they're going to be a lot more aggressive. They're going to be a lot more dangerous. And so to kind of set that up, kind of like giving you like an early boss, you know, the Glass Joe type, and then all of a sudden then have yourself like a real threat to come after that, to where the protagonists underestimate that threat, you know, because as soon as they see that more are landing, you know, they think that this is going to be a hunt, right? This is in a way kind of like aliens, like, oh, we're going to go out and we're going to kill all these things and it's going to be fun. And then, no, it's not going to be fun. These things are more dangerous, more violent. And I don't know what this means in the film, but they're more black, which, did you catch anything off of that? Did you get like that there's something more to that, or is that just kind of a stylistic idea?
I think it was stylistic. I mean, one of the things about this film, first off, it's shot at night and you can put people in those black outfits and it makes them so you don't have to really worry about like lighting them. So you don't have to really worry, you know, it's what is easier on the cinematography and such. And it kind of, you know, because they almost feel like a void.
Well, they are a void. And yeah. I would say that this is kind of requiring anti-lighting, if anything, that you would have to like, especially considering that they're setting up that these are blacker than black, you know, that it's almost like it just eats light, you know, light doesn't reflect off it, period. And I love how they put their hands in it and it completely swallows their hand. I've never seen an effect like that before. That, and I don't think I've seen it since. And I think that that's a really good concept that really, could be used, especially in more, science fiction horror films, in my opinion. But, the lighting for that, because you have to be able to make it so that everything else is visible so that you can completely void that space so it doesn't muddle, right? So that you can kind of differentiate the creature from the rest of the black. So that's very, very interesting in that aspect. But I don't know, it's just especially considering that we have a very multi-ethnic cast here. You know, this is made up of a wide range, especially in England, of a very different looking boys that make up this group. And then, of course, we also have the girls that will make up their own little group. And then, of course, the other tenants of this block, right?
Right.
But I guess at this particular point, though, let's talk about these aliens a little bit more. Because what did you find very fascinating? What do you think is kind of the best characteristic that comes off of this creature?
I think it's interesting is that Spielberg has often said that the eyes are very important for character. You know, it's one of the things with E.T., you want to make sure like the eyes were right and such. Mm-hmm. And here you have an alien that there are no eyes and they only have like these bioluminescent teeth, these rows of teeth. Mm-hmm. And it's just very interesting. So not only visually are they just like blacker than black and they feel like a black hole, and it's like right in the middle is this mesmerizing there's that fish that lives down in the deeps of the ocean and has that one little light that attracts like prey to it, and it almost kind of, you know, felt like that, like those teeth, that was really interesting.
I will say that is very... I love the fact that they're also kind of neon as well. So it's not even just kind of like natural white. It's that kind of like, you know, like this bluish tint to them, which kind of is both kind of, you know, it's kind of pretty until, you know, you realize that their teeth, very sharp, pointy teeth, you know, the kind that just look like they're going to rip you apart. And when you definitely see that, and especially kind of the way that it's a slow reveal. You know, it's like they see the monster, you have a couple of shots of their reaction, then you see the monster starting to show its teeth. And then when you see the teeth, and at that particular point, you know that they're in serious trouble. And then, of course, later on, you'll see them actually attacking. And, you know, you'll see them, you know, gnaw down on the leg of a character. And the way that it reveals that threat, I think is very interesting, especially considering that all the characters that we're going to be rooting for are, what, 15 or younger? You know, that's, you know, especially when we're thinking about, you know, a very dangerous creature, you know, attacking, especially in a horror film, we expect death. But, you know, when you have characters that are under the age of 15, we are more apt to worry about them simply because of their age. And the idea of them being killed by these creatures has to be a little bit more disconcerting. Or at least that's kind of where I came from with this.
But, me too. Yeah, me too.
You know, and especially considering how we see them attack. We also see the fact that, you know, they're able to run away from these creatures on their bikes. So it's not as though like these are, you know, that these are impossibly fast. You know, we're not talking about kind of supernatural creatures. They do have limitations, and we see those limitations pretty quickly. And if it weren't for the fact that we're worried about 15-year-olds, like, you know, what we see later on that, you know, the police are attacking these creatures. You know, that there is actually, you know, something going on beyond this block in regards to the response to these creatures, right? But it's not one of those things where we're going to be worried about the fate of humanity. You know, this is kind of a, you know, this is a threat, but it's not a global threat. It's not, you know, a world-ending apocalypse threat, right?
Right. This is not Independence Day.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, it's like, but we're not worried about London. We're just worried about these seven kids. We're worried about, you know, about them getting safe from these creatures, and the fact that these creatures are persistent and they chase them like it's no one's business. And especially when you have a film like this, the question you're going to constantly be asking is, why are they chasing these kids like this? You know, what is it about these kids that they, you know, that all these other people, London is a very, you know, big place, lots of people that they could attack. Why are they so insistent on these kids? And of course, we'll get that answer later on. But I just, the fact that they're just so many, and they just keep coming and they keep coming and they keep coming, and they cause so much mayhem, you know, with their attacks, right?
Yeah, because if I, you know, it, you know, I did get that, because when you have that one shot of when you see the building, and all of a sudden there's like all these, you know, aliens going up it, and it's mm-hmm. and it's like, first off, oh my goodness, had no idea there's going to be that many, and second, it's just like, you know, why are they doing this? And it was like that moment, it was like, okay, this has to go back to the one that Moses killed in the beginning, mm-hmm. because you're right, there's makes no sense when you have that many aliens why they would just go after this one group. They would, you know, naturally you'd think, oh, if this was a natural invasion or just wanting territory, they would be going other places, other floors, other things like that. So you realize, because of this relentless just going after this one group, that it has to be something other than a regular invasion or just a fight for territory. It has to be something more than that.
But another thing that I love about what this story does is it also requires that that this group have to confront their victim from the beginning of the film. You know, that she kind of puts herself into that, because she does get the police involved, and they also set that up where they're on the street looking for them because she knew, you know, certain characteristics, especially Moses's, you know, his hat, I think, was one of the big things that she kind of fixated on. And so throughout the film, they're constantly colliding with one another, and they're kind of having to see each other, you know, in kind of what they've done to the other in one way or the other. And especially for this group of boys that really have never had to worry about seeing their victim again. I mean, as it turns out, she lives in the exact same complex as they do. And I love the fact that they seem to be more upset about the fact that they mugged one of their own, one of the people in their own block, than they did that they mugged anyone to begin with. It's like, well, if you were someone that we would never see again, then that's one thing. But, you know, there's that possibility we could run into you again, and that, you know, that you're part of us, that you're one of, you know, that's that tribalism, that's territory, right? And I guess in a way you could also kind of compare that to the creatures and their territorialism, right?
Yeah, because, you know, that says a lot about Moses. It's like Moses is like, you know, this is my crew, these are my friends, and, you know, we do have a code. We protect our block. You know, that's one of the reasons why they end up, you know, wanting to go after the creatures. This is our block. Nobody does anything to us. Nobody does anything to our home. And, you know, that is something that we have to deal with every day, even currently, that whole idea of, well, we need to do what we do to protect our own. And if you're somebody else, well, then you don't matter. And, you know, she does bring that point. It's like, wait, what do you mean? Like, if I didn't live here, that would be okay? Like, what? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that, you know, she comes from an opportunity of a wider worldview, and these kids really don't. They've only known the block. So again, you know, it does that juxtaposition of, like, what is right and what is wrong when it comes to these kids.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the fact that they're you know, that they're about protecting their block, because another character that does say that this is my block, although probably for less noble intentions, is Hi Hat. In fact, those are his last words. You know, this is my block. But at the same time, I don't think it's because he wants to protect the block. I think it's because, you know, he sees that as his little kingdom, right? That you know, that's where his money and his influence originates from, right? I mean, he's kind of a businessman. You know, he deals in drugs. He's getting into the rap game. If I'm not correct, that was his song that he keeps singing. If I'm not correct, I could be wrong on that, but I swear that he said that was his. One thing that should be said is that they aren't very friendly in regards to the language, or not the language, but the dialect. This is very Cockney, very. If you don't have the subtitles on, you could miss things.
Oh, yes. I turned the subtitles on this time, and I was like, I got everything this time. It's like, yeah.
They didn't have that in the theaters. I had to follow along, and I thought I caught everything, but without the subtitles, yeah, it is hard.
Yeah, because not only is it, first off, it's that area, specific area of London. They call it the Ends. It's, you know, this tower, so it's this one part. Not only that, but it's I always find it fascinating when countries take something that's basically American. Hip-hop culture is American. And so our version of hip-hop gets exported to places like South Korea, and then you see it like in the influence in K-pop, and then you see it in Britain. And in this film, you see that American hip-hop influence. And it's really interesting to see that. So not only do you have like their local colloquialisms and their local dialect, you have them sort of getting into like rap, which is an American export. So it's very interesting to actually try to follow along this, the dialogue that they have with each other.
That's very true. And I think that's another thing about, you know, especially when you're talking about exporting hip hop and kind of that culture, there's a lot of the little subtle things that are kind of thrown out there, I think are pretty interesting, considering especially this territory or this part of England and of London specifically. But, you know, you do get like these little throwaways to American culture, American euphemisms. But at the same time, there's also something that's kind of been transformed into a very European, you know, kind of, or I guess very British, you know, take on it. And I think that's kind of fun and funny, especially when it comes to like video games. The whole idea is like, maybe we should just go home, you know, just go home and play FIFA. You know, that's, you know, to me, when I heard that for the first time, that I got the biggest laugh out of that because, you know, that's what you would expect with any kid their age. You know, it's like, why are you going out and mugging people? You can go just, you know, if you got an Xbox, go play it. Don't, you know, you don't need to get yourself into trouble with cops. But, you know, at the same time though, and I love the fact that it keeps coming back. You know, even Moses himself says, we should have just stayed home and played FIFA. Like, to me, I love when, you know, you have these kinds of throwbacks. And on top of that, that's also kind of, if I'm not correct, even the Goonies had kind of, that kind of thing. It was like, you know, we should have just stayed home. We shouldn't have gone out on this. We shouldn't have gotten ourselves involved. Kind of mentality, right?
Yeah, you know, like there's that moment in Goonies with the well, mm-hmm. Where everybody wants to, you know, everybody thinks about leaving, and you know, then he makes that, you know, little speech, you know, like, down here, you know, this is for us right now. So yeah, there is that, you know, moment of, do you just give up and you know, ride your bikes back and just play video games, or you know, do you leave through the well, or do you just keep going? And you know, Moses steps up and, you know, says we should keep going.
Yeah. Let's talk about the kids' weaponry, so to say, because I found this very fascinating. Now, obviously, this is set in England. They have very restrictive gun laws, so we're not going to see a whole lot of guns here, although there is one gun and one sort of gun in this movie. But at the same time, though, you know, we see these kids holding machetes, katanas, baseball bats, very long knives, and especially fireworks. Now, are you familiar with the holiday that this is happening? Because this is all happening in one night. This all takes place, if I want to say, probably within like the time frame of about, what, 4 or 5 hours? You know,
yeah,
real time. You know, from what I understand, this is the 5th of November. This is Guy Fawkes Day. You know, this is, you know, this is why we see a whole lot of fireworks. The cops mentioned it earlier on that with as many people that are out, it's going to be very difficult to find these kids because there's just way too many people out on the streets. You know, we see a lot of fireworks, which of course can definitely hide the alien invasion a little bit easier, since, you know, people could see them as just fireworks falling down. You know, so I thought it was very interesting that they set that up. And on top of that, because, you know, one of our protagonists is, well, he's big on fireworks and other explosions and seems to have a lot of them. You know, he's our banger, right? I think that's, in fact, what they kind of, that's the term that they call him, is banger, isn't it?
Pest. It's Pest.
Well, yeah, the character's name is Pest, but Pest. If I'm not correct, they keep calling him Banger because he has all the fireworks. And he's got a firework for every occasion. Like, seriously, that guy has more explosives on him than Mad Dog Murdoch in the A-Team. Jeez. Like,
I know. He's the American that, you know, stocks up on July 4th things on July 5th. You know, just, you know, continually builds up the fireworks stock over the course of the year.
But I have to admit, though, they use those fireworks for very interesting in very interesting ways, and I love how they find a use for all the different types of fireworks. You know, they use fireworks to scare off the aliens. They use them for flashlights. They use them for diversion. You know, they'll even use the fireworks to set off the real big explosion to kill them. Right?
Yep.
You know, they use those fireworks for pretty much every different type of thing. And on top of that, one of the things I love is that these fireworks set off smoke. It's not as though they're, you know, that they're just kind of taking that out, you know, that particular aspect of fireworks for granted. There's lots of smoke that comes from these fireworks. The only problem that I find is that no one's coughing or choking on that smoke. Especially like when we get into the later scene in the hallway where they're using the Roman candles to, you know, to light their way, right?
Yeah, they fired those down the hall and it makes, oh, but it's a great effect though, them getting all lost, and it's very sort of, you know, like the fog and
yeah,
and everything. You know, poor Jerome. But it, Yeah, I see what you mean, but it's just still such a cool effect, and I give it to him. I give it to him.
Well, you brought up that you know, the Jerome does get killed in the hallway. He's not the only of our protagonists to get killed by these things, but I find it very interesting why they got killed specifically. In the case of, I think it was Dennis. Dennis, you know, he takes the cap gun from the kids, and he thought it was a real gun. And so when he goes to fire the real gun at the aliens, he finds out that it's a cap gun. And of course, because he left himself open, he basically just became, you know, chow time. Which is also interesting because the way that they differentiated him from the other group is because he had the helmet on, right?
Right.
So he looked like he was the most protected of the group, because he was the one that seemed to have armor or some sort of armor. And yet he was the first of the group to get killed. And I love how they set that up. It's like he tries to fire the gun, and of course he finds out it's a cap gun, and then of course they jump all over him and, you know, tear him apart. But we don't actually see them murder him. We see them jump on him, we see the hat fall off, and then we see some blood, but we don't actually see him getting torn up. We'll see high hats be ripped to shreds by these guys. Well, we see one of his crew, his chauffeur at the beginning of the film get torn up. We don't see the other two dimwits, that are in the elevator. That happens off screen. But the two of our protagonists that get killed, they do so off screen. With Jerome, it's because of the fog. You know, he gets, we see him get dragged off, and then we hear him get torn up. But we don't actually see him die, which I think is very interesting. But did you catch that? Or
I did, because to me, you know, there are those who love like the gory type of stuff, like, you know, like the later Saw films or like what I call torture porn. And I'm not one of those, you know, like I said, like Carpenter is, you know, one of my favorites, and you can still get fear and tension by having the deaths off screen, you know, or the seeing the blood, or just seeing a little bit of the tearing. Cause you know, it's like, okay, the guy's throat's getting ripped. Okay. You kind of know what's going to happen, next. You know, you don't have to, you know, see everything. And I like your point about the, you know, the Dennis being protected and stuff, because also the obvious thing with hi-hats and his gun, the guns don't really work.
Well, I mean, the gun does work. I mean, Hi-Hats kills that first one with the guns. And he even kills the second one, the one that gets in the elevator with the guns. He's the only one that survives. Yeah. But as especially with how he goes out, he doesn't have enough guns for what's to come. In fact, I don't even know if he has any bullets by that particular point, because he's been firing off at everybody. Also, it's very interesting that even while he has an alien invasion, he's more interested in killing Moses for disrespecting him than he is about the aliens that are tearing up his men.
I know. He's Hi-Hats, you know, out of everyone, it's like almost to me, he's like the most American of them, because he, you know, he thinks guns are just going to be the way to solve everything. Yeah, he kills a couple, but again, it's one of those things to where, you know, when it comes to the situation, bullets run out, or that whole sort of, you know, my territory, I'm the king, my way or no way or whatever, who cares who else is attacking us, you still have to obey me, sort of mentality and everything. So he's just, you know, the way that he goes out, it says a lot about the point of view of the film.
Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, considering that there are guns in this particular universe, we don't actually see any of our protagonists actually use a gun, with the exception of Dennis, who thinks he has one. Which, in a way, I want to say that in a way that because of his belief in the gun is what got him killed. Would we feel differently if these kids had their hands on guns, if they were actively using guns to kill these aliens?
I don't think I would feel any differently about them, because that would say more about the world they live in than them, and such. Because I know it's kind of weird, because I'm American. I don't know, like, I was born and raised in America. I don't know what your background is, Eric, but so it's kind of odd. You know, I grew up around guns and stuff like that, but knowing that there are different gun laws in England, So it'd be kind of weird, because I know in Britain, if all these kids had guns, that would say something, one thing to them, but it says something to us. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of odd to critique it that way, because again, you know, this is made in Britain. These are, you know, British actors and, you know, it says in London. And so for me, it really wouldn't, I think, have the impact that it would perhaps on like the British audience or something. Does that make sense?
I get what you're saying. And as a born and raised Texan, where we are proud of the fact that we have more guns in our state than we have people. Honestly, though, I think that's it, kind of going back to the Goonies. And bear in mind that, you know, when it comes to England, yeah, there's the strict restrictive gun laws, and that definitely does kind of play a part in this movie. But at the same time, though, we've also seen Guy Ritchie movies where there seems to be no such differentiation. Everyone seems to have a gun, including the nuns. So, to me, though, I think that if there were more guns, and I know that this was something that Joe Cornish specifically said he didn't want the kids to be wielding guns, because if he did, then it would be a completely different movie. And I think that he's right on this, that even though there's violence and blood and gore, there's still a bit of innocence in these kids. This group of boys, yeah, they've done bad things, but nothing that we can't forgive them for at this particular point. Nothing that they can't come back from. And in a way that this movie is kind of them defining themselves as to what kind of people they are. They could have easily just gone home and played FIFA. Instead, they took this up. They took up the challenge of dealing with this. We don't see any of them running off and going, screw you, you deal with this. Even when they recognize that Moses brought this on them, they still stuck together. And so there is a bit of innocence in this, even with the realities kind of still in there, you know, that these kids, by not using guns, by, you know, using their other wits and their other abilities, kind of still allows them to be, I don't know, just it provides them with a little bit more strength, in my opinion, than if they were just all of a sudden taking 45s and going full John Woo on these things. Which they could have easily done.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you know, we have to remember these are teenagers, and you're right about them being innocent and more creative and more inventive, because the adults are the ones that do have the guns. Because now that I think about it, when the police come at the end, it's not just, hey, we're the police. It's, you know, armed police.
Yeah.
You know, we are the armed police coming. And at the end, when everybody's, you know, chanting, you know, Moses, 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 you know, you're right. You know, that innocence, you know, won the day, that creative, that creativity, that, you know, we are going to step up and do this with our knives and baseball bats and fireworks, because we care about this block in a way that no armed police force could.
And let's talk about the police and what they represent in this movie, because, it is very interesting, because we're having to look at it from the character's perspective, in the sense that the police aren't really there to protect them, or that we kind of get that feeling from them, because even when it comes to the two police officers that are going around with Sam, you know, to find the people who mugged her, they're basically just kind of appeasing her, right? They really didn't think that they were going to be able to find who did it, and even when they did, they really weren't fully aware of their location. They were kind of bumbling. We get the monologue about how, you know, if they call the cops to the block, then they're basically gonna just pin this all on the kids, because, you know, especially considering that they did steal a cop car, even though it was to escape from the creatures. There are two murdered cops. They're not going to accept that it was a monster that killed them. They're going to pin the blame on the kids, so that they can get some sort of conviction. You know, we get that moment when Moses is kind of angry, and it's, we have to talk about Moses in just a little bit, because, you know, he has that moment where, you know, he's like, you know, the cops are the ones that brought these aliens, and we know that in a way he doesn't believe that, but it's that anger, that frustration, the fact that, you know, to them he is a thug, to them he is, you know, he's an easy mark, he is someone that they can pin everything on, and they're not going to feel bad. And you know, and that frustration you can definitely feel in that moment. You know, and it's something that is always there, even to the end of the film. I mean, even though he does blow up the aliens, they're hauling him off to jail. And they probably, we don't know exactly what's going to happen to him, because what are they going to pin on him? Are they going to, pin the explosion? Are they going to try to put the dead cops on him? Are they going to try to pin him on the vehicle that was stolen? Or, you know, I guess, you know, commandeer, you know, how much is her, Sam's, you know, when Sam decides that she's going to stand up for him, at the end, how much is that going to hold sway in the court? Where exactly is all of this going to lie? And in a way, the way that the community, the block, calls his name, you know, it's very interesting, kind of the complex nature. You know, even without the aliens, this would be very compelling as to what's happening with him, right? Because he did do these things. You cannot deny that he did rob this woman. He did steal a cop car. You know, these are not things that he can say that he didn't do. But out of context, it's one of those things, right? It's the complexity that this film is holding on to, even though it is about, you know, kids fighting aliens.
Yeah, he almost seems like, you know, that outside world, again, you know, outside of the block, you're going to see an angry black kid who you just think, I'm a thug, so you know what, I'm going to play the part of the angry black guy who's just a thug, and you see me that way, then fine, I'll be that way, that's to the outside world, because he knows the people of, you know, the block see him a different way. And then at the end, you know, when they're like, you know, he's happy when the block realizes what he did, you know, like at the end, he has that look of, you know, he hears them chanting and it's like the block has approved of him. The block understands. He knows, to me, like he knows, like when he's being willed away, the outside world probably won't, but the block understands and the block approves, and he seems to be okay with that.
But that's the thing I love about John Boyega's performance. And again, I can't go back. I can't relate just how strong this performance feels to me, especially when it comes to that first time I saw it. Because up to this point, I had never heard of anyone but Nick Frost. And I didn't even realize it was Nick Frost until near the end of the film, because my brain was more interested in these kids than I was about, you know, the fat guy whose apartment that holds the weed room. And so watching this character, and especially considering that he's playing it as the strong silent type. You know, this is a film archetype that goes back pretty much till the beginning of film. You know, your protagonist who doesn't say much, but what he does say holds a lot of weight. And Moses really doesn't say a whole lot. You know, a lot of that goes back to his gang, specifically Pest. Pest is the one that just can't seem to shut up to save his life. But, you know, when Moses does talk, it's usually because he has something he has to say, or something that is very important to what's going to happen, right? And the way that John Boyega, who up to this point, I believe he'd only been in like a couple of TV series as a minor actor, he naturally carries this group. He feels like the leader. The way that this performance works is just shows how charismatic he is, even when he doesn't say anything. And I knew watching this that this guy was going to get big. And I've said so for many years, up to the point when he did actually become big. I feel very vindicated, because I believe that this is a guy that deserves all the opportunities and all the love that he's now getting, because, you know, he is a big shot now. And, you know, at this particular point, he's not only acting, he's now producing. In fact, he's a part of the producers of the latest Pacific Rim film, which I'll be honest, I can't wait for. I don't care what, it could look bad in the trailers, I'll still go see it, because Pacific Rim, love it. But that's a whole different story, though. But what is your opinion of Moses and John Boyega's performance?
Yeah, John Boyega, he's able to, you could have had someone that could have just been up there, just looked mean, and, and just, you know, like stomped the way through and just tried to be, I don't know, try to out-gorilla the gorilla. Mm-hmm. But instead, he's, you can tell he's like this captain, even though he, there are moments when you can see that he probably doesn't want it, but somehow he's like taking it, and you know there's something more to him. I don't know. It's like the way he carries his body, you know, how he just with his eyes, you know, it is one of those things that where you don't notice the performance until you've seen it again, which that's my favorite type of actor. I love being able to watch a movie and then afterwards, you know, just this character and what happened and not really going, oh, that performance was astounding. It's like, no, I shouldn't notice the performance until I've seen it like again. And that's the type of thing you get from this movie and his performance. You don't realize he's acting until you've seen it again. And, you know, like when he was cast in Star Wars and everyone was like, I don't know about this guy. I'm like going, dude, it's the guy from Attack the Block. We're fine.
Yeah.
And everything. So, yeah.
No, that's exactly my feelings when it came to his casting in Star Wars. And I'll be honest here. I wanted a lot more John Boyega in The Force Awakens, and I'm really hoping that we're going to get more in the later sequels. And quite honestly, it's like in everything that he does, and in all, I went and saw him in Detroit earlier this year. I absolutely loved it. Especially loved his performance. You know, I keep up with what he's working on because I find him to be a very interesting actor and one that I really want to see grow. Grow to be even bigger, and it looks like he is going in that direction. And interesting enough, he is probably the name that is going to be the biggest coming out of this. Obviously, Nick Frost, not exactly a lightweight in his own in his own right. But we also have another actor who is. I mean, she kind of came in big a few years ago when she started in Broadchurch, but it looks like her geek cred is about to jump up like 12 billion within the next year or so. But yeah, any idea what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you think being the first female Doctor Who might have something to do with that?
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You know, with me, I've seen like the first three episodes of Broadchurch. She is a great actor. I can't wait to see what she does with this. Although I'm like three seasons behind on Doctor Who, so I have to catch up before the next season shows up or by the Christmas special at this point. But yeah, I mean, I'll be honest here though. Even when they announced Jodie Whittaker is the new Doctor. I completely forgot that she was in Attack the Block. she's not the worst part in this movie or the worst performance in this movie. I'm going to give that to Bruce, to the rich white kid. Oh my God. What? That was awful. I mean, that every scene that he was in felt like it could have been cut, right? In fact, I think that the only reason why his scenes were still in was just to make sure that this film reached feature length time, right? Because yeah. Other than the fact that he's the one who kind of introduces that they killed the female and then they're coming after him because they got her pheromones on them. There's absolutely no reason, and he really has absolutely no chemistry with Nick Frost. And he's kind of playing the second fiddle, so it's like a third set of comic relief, even though we already have the Probs and Mayhem. So we don't really need another set of comic relief. And let's be honest here, Nick Frost without Simon Pegg is kind of at a handicap. Just a tiny bit. Yeah. But no, that character, oh my God, he's the most annoying, right? Or can you defend him? I'm just curious.
Yeah, out of all of this, he's, you know, one of those yet another useless white kids who gets high and who benefits from being like the white guy and then who gets to be all white guy by going, hey, I went to university and so I know this stuff and let me do the white guy thing. That is probably one of my nitpicks about the movie is that character. So I completely see your point. So
It was just that the character's bad, the way he's performed, because he's trying to be silly. He's trying to be goofy. And the thing is that he's just not that good at it. You know, it's like it, you know, like when he jumps behind the bush because he hears the sirens, right? We're supposed to believe that, you know, that he's all paranoid and that he's just high and, he's going to have to explain to his daddy how his, like his Volvo, is it a Volvo or?
Yeah, that car. Yeah.
You know, how his car got destroyed. And we're supposed to care about this character or, you know, find it just funny that he's jumping over a bush. I mean, again, it was just so misplaced, and there's nothing really interesting about this character. And, you know, and they kind of build him up a little bit in this movie, and it's like, why? Is there like deleted scenes that, you know, that he was like a more prominent part, and you realize that this guy has no charisma, so you just try to cut him out as much as possible? You know, is this like a Jar Jar situation?
I don't know.
One of those questions that'll never be answered.
Yeah.
But Sam is, she's very vanilla, right? I mean, they try to give her some backstory, you know, with the, you know, that she went to university, you know, she's a med student, she just got out of residency. So, you know, she knows her way around, or maybe she's just starting her residency.
She's a nurse.
Oh, she's a nurse. Yeah. But, you know, we really don't understand exactly why it is that she's living in this block, you know, considering that they kind of set this up as this kind of like low income area. I mean, if she's making, I mean, we look at her apartment, she's doing pretty well. You know, why is she living here? You know, lots of questions that the movie doesn't answer, which probably would have given her a little bit more backstory, but they kind of just make her out to be, you know, just a white girl, you know, afraid of non-white people a little bit, right?
Well, it's not so much that she was afraid of the kids, because she was on the phone and she just, you know, like crosses the street. She doesn't realize that she's in trouble until she gets surrounded. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not so much that you see like a couple. She realizes like when those two kids get behind her and then she sees the others. That's, I think, when she, you know, reasonably, you're surrounded by people. Yeah. It doesn't matter. You know, it's like something wrong's going to happen. But, you know, this is a very tight movie. It's like, what, 90 minutes barely?
Yeah. It's 1 hour and 29 minutes. It's just 1 minute shy of 90 minutes.
Yeah. So I think when you've got, you know, bare bones filmmaking and everything, I think some of the things that they did was sacrifice probably some of like her backstory and such, and so they could focus on Moses and our Goonies and like the threat of the aliens. So it's one of those things that, you know, like she has that moment where she kills the alien that's about to get Moses when Moses has his blade stuck in the wall and such. And she does end up trusting him enough to, you know, go to the apartment and turn on the gas and everything. So, you know, it is one of those things to where, like, she wasn't annoying and she, you know, she ended up keeping all her clothes on and all that type of stuff. So, I'm sorry. I'm a woman, so I notice all the time when a woman starts a movie clothed, and then for some reason, as the movie goes on, she ends up with less clothes. But this is a case of where she, you know, has all her clothes at the end. And, you know, does stuff to where it doesn't bother me that much.
I get you. But let's talk about the finale. Because they set this up that this is Moses' fault. Moses takes the responsibility of what happened. And so he's going to deal with this. This is also the chance that we get. This is the only moment that we get to see a little bit of Moses' backstory when Sam goes into his apartment. The only apartment that we didn't actually see going in. Right, so they already kind of set that up, that whatever's in that apartment is going to play some part, right? Because he's the only backstory that we didn't get in that montage of the other boys when they go home to get their weapons, right?
Right.
And so when she sees that he basically has been living on his own for God knows how long, especially if we take that sleeping bag into account, probably years on his own. How does that make us feel about this character before, you know, from before to after this revelation. Does this set up more sympathy towards them? Does this kind of set, you know, do they already have this expectation going forward? What did you feel about this?
It made sense, because it's like, you don't get a survival skill set like he has coming from a certain environment. I mean, I don't want to be like stereotypical and stuff, but he has to have a certain set of skills, and they have to, you know, he has them, and he had to be developed somehow, and he had to get it somehow. And so it was one of those things to where, you know, yeah, I can understand. He's had to feed himself and clothe himself and make sure he goes to school or something like that. So he's had to grow up, you know, very quickly. And it just kind of brought everything full circle for me anyway.
For me, it's like we kind of already got that implication, especially kind of just how defensive he is. But to kind of see that firsthand definitely kind of punctuated what was already kind of implied. For me specifically, I find this scene to be one that isn't revealing as much as just affirming kind of what we already knew about this character, and kind of affirming why it is that he's protective of his friends, specifically that you know, the people that stick by him, he's going to be extremely loyal to, and probably even the reason why he was very upset about attacking someone on the block, right? Because in a way, the people that are in that block are the ones that don't walk away from him, you know. That they are still there. They are part of his life, and that community, that block, is his home in that sense, right?
Right.
So, and the fact that he decides to use that apartment to basically lure the aliens to destroy it, right? To destroy them. Although, how does he? She escapes the apartment before him. Is able to. I'm assuming that he lives on the same floor as Nick Frost. Is that kind of what we're getting?
One floor down.
Okay, so she was able to get one floor down without luring the aliens, even though she has been around. She's been around Moses enough that she probably has the fluorescence on her, right? Or the
no, she never touched the actual female, and that's when they're in the weed room, and
you're right.
Bland white boy takes the light, and he's like, "You're clean," and everything. So she's able to, because they don't see these aliens or smell, and so that's how they were able to track. How she's able to escape, because she, you know, smells clean.
You're right. And that also, because Hi Hats put the glasses on the female, so he got it all over him, which is why they dived all over him.
Right.
But yeah, so she gets one floor down and was able to set up the trap. And then of course we get that glorious slow-mo, where Moses basically is just jumping and diving, and his full-on action sequence, right? This is the moment of truth, right?
Yeah, this is his hero moment. He stepped up and he took responsibility. You know, he realizes, hey, this is my fault. And I think he earns it because he accepts responsibility and he's like, I have a plan. I'm going to do something about it. I think he deserves that slow-mo hero moment.
Well, I think so, too. On top of that, this is a pretty action-intense scene. And understand that this film, I think, was like $5 million. This is a very low budget film. This did not get a whole lot of. This is not a very expensive film to make. And yet at the same time, the way that they use the action sequences, especially with these creatures and setting the scene up and then paying it off at the end, because we set it up that Moses could die. Doing this. He's risking his life to kill these creatures, and he's willing to accept that he's going to die from this, right?
Right.
And so when he does set off the fireworks that sets off the gas and blows up his apartment, we pretty much think that he's dead up until the reveal, right?
Yeah.
And why the hell would he have a Union Jack in his apartment to hang off of? I'll be honest here. It's like, especially considering his feelings towards, you know, the towards the police and kind of towards the state. Why would he have a Union Jack? That seems very surprising to me.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm getting a James Bond vibe from it. You know, when James Bond would pull the ripcord and the Union Jack is on his parachute. You know, that kind of pro-British, you know, fuck yeah kind of thing. But I don't know. Just it. I don't see Moses being, you know, for the, you know, for queen and country type. But who knows? Maybe that's going to be the next 00.
Who knows?
Hey, I would say this. I wouldn't mind John Boyega taking over after Daniel Craig. Just throwing it out there. You know, Idris Elba's a little too old. I understand that. But, you know, I would sign that petition.
I'd go for it.
Especially since he's willing to dangle from the jack to, you know, to defeat the aliens. I mean, this can't be any more Will Smith, right?
I think that's where it kind of comes from. This is his hero moment. This is the, you know, we defeated the aliens. We didn't do it with a huge spaceship and a weird virus, but here's our hero. He made it, you know, sort of moment.
And he's dangling from the flag.
Yep.
And then, of course, then we get the real hero music. And I have to admit, I love this finale music, you know, as they're escorting Moses into the police van. Doesn't it just feel triumphant, you know, like, you know, that he's saved the day, he's won the hour, you know, he has the people chanting his name to this music. It feels, you know, just truly like, you know, like a rah-rah moment, right? You know, it also kind of has that John Carpenter kind of synth vibe. You know, I'd almost feel like, you know, like John Carpenter kind of was an influence on this particular part of the score. Just a little bit, right?
Yeah, probably just a little.
But, you know, you have Moses. And, of course, you have that smile, that affirmation that, you know, no matter what the rest of the country will do to him, the block is his. That, you know, he will be remembered. And he'll be remembered fondly by the block. And how did you feel about that? What was your final feeling after the movie's over and the credits start to roll?
Part of me wanted that, you know, post-credit scene of, you know, him walking out of jail and everything being okay. But I think that would have betrayed what the movie is about. This movie, you know, from the beginning plagued with the expectations of, you know, oh, you think this is what a hero is? Well, let me present you a hero that mugs a woman at the beginning of the movie. Here he is. He's hanging from the flag and everybody's chanting, but oh, he's being carted away in the police van. I think it's just one of those things that it, on one hand, it's like, oh my goodness, what happens? But then I don't know. It's fitting for me that it ends that way.
Yeah. And I think that it has to end on that particular vibe. It has to, because he cannot, you know, and I think that's one of the things I think the film really gets across is that even because he does this one thing, it's not going to erase the things that he's done before. Hopefully he'll be given the chance to, you know, to become better. And maybe this moment is that moment that, you know, he gets that chance, that maybe this alien invasion might have been able to save him from a life that would come out even worse. We won't know. We hope. But at the same time, though, the film isn't going to give us that reassurance. It's not going to say that everything's going to be out nice and rosy. We can just hope. And I think that hope is the one thing that I think the film does great with, is that because if it really wanted to be down, it could have just shown us that he has been sent to prison. He'll be in prison for 20 years. But it doesn't give us that. It gives us him getting that hero moment, him getting the recognition of the block. The fact that Sam is calling him a hero instead of condemning him for what he's done, right? These things give us the hope that he's going to be given that chance. And it's up to us to determine whether he gets that chance or not. And that I'm perfectly happy with, especially with that awesome finale music. You know, you want to believe, right?
Yes.
And in a way, that kind of still reminds me of Carpenter, because Carpenter also loves to end on notes of, you're not exactly sure what's going to happen next. You know, Halloween was notorious for that. Obviously, we get Halloween 2 from that. The Thing, we don't know what happens to McCreary. We never get to know the mist. I mean, he leaves us on ambiguous notes. His greatest films are the ones that leave us on an ambiguous note. We don't know what happens next. And we don't know what happens next year. So I cannot give a more fitting, tip of the hat to a film for understanding Carpenter, because other directors who try to do John Carpenter usually fail because they don't understand what makes his films work. And I think that Joe Cornish does. Even though I think that he'll probably note every other director besides Carpenter as an influence. But I think the strongest one for this one is John Carpenter, easily. But I guess I'll just have to ask him when I get the chance. But at this point, were there any other things that we wanted to bring up about this film? Because we're actually about to run longer than the film itself at this point.
I know. This is what's interesting about this movie. You think it's one thing, but then when you start to dissect it, there's so much more to it.
And we didn't even bring up the girls that basically kicked that alien's ass with the...
Oh, with an ice skate. I love those two with a lamp and an ice skate. I love that part.
You know, they didn't even think twice. They didn't just go screaming off like the stereotypical girls. No, it's like, the boys can kill these things, we can kill it too. So bam. It's just, they didn't even think twice. Like, break open the lamp, yank it a cattle prod, grab some ice skates, let's do this. Yeah. No help from the boys, they just do it. That is awesome. But, they did touch it, so of course they got chlamydia, right? I'm sorry, I love that line. It turned out that was actually an improv line. Cornish just asked one of the girls, like, would you touch that? And it's like, I don't want to get chlamydia. So he wrote that into the screenplay. That's awesome.
That's cool.
All right. So at this point, I think we pretty much did all the geek sheet. I will just mention a guest right quick. Joe Cornish was involved in the writing of the Adventures of Tintin movie directed by Steven Spielberg. He's got a new movie coming out next year that's kind of a modern take on the King Arthur story. I think he also did some work on Ant-Man as one of the writers. He's been pretty busy since Attack the Block. So I guess we got that, and I can't wait to see what he does next. Are you interested in seeing his next movie?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what he does.
Well, I do know that from what it sounds like, he's got a pretty amazing cast, including Patrick Stewart, coming in for his next one. So I'm very eager to see what he does. But I guess at this time, it's time to ask the age-old question. Michelle, do you agree with the critics on Attack the Block? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe?
Well, if the critics loved it, then I agree. Then it's a pass, because this is amazing. I recommend it. I even recommend you see it a couple of times. So, yeah, this is a high recommend for me.
For me, this makes my yearly rotation. I love this movie. If I find out that a friend of mine hasn't seen this movie, I immediately pull them over and make them watch it. And I've never heard a person say a bad thing about this movie, because it is just that awesome. I love this movie. Cannot recommend it enough. Easy pass. And especially with it becoming the Halloween period, this is a great time. Get a bunch of friends together. You're going to have a fun time with this, especially if you like anything of the kind of Edgar Wright type. This is easily part of that type of filmmaking. And yes, Edgar Wright was a producer of this film. So if you need that excuse, there's your excuse. But Michelle, where can people find you on the internet?
On Twitter, I'm at Michelle Ely. I'm one of the co-hosts of the Starlight Tribune podcast, which is part of the Gunna Geek Network. And that's basically where you can find me.
And if you have any questions, or if you want to talk about your opinions on Attack the Block, you can definitely do so on our Facebook page, as well as Twitter, at Art House Legends. And if you just want to be quiet about it and just want to send us a nice little note, you can do so, arthouselegends@gmail.com. And I will get back to you as soon as possible. Michelle, thank you for joining us for this amazing conversation. Just to keep everyone in mind that we do have Art House of Horror coming up next month, which will be next week. We've got a killer four movies that you really need to pay attention to. We have Killer Clowns from Outer Space. We have the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original Night of the Living Dead, and a little indie film that has a lot of firepower behind it called Green Room. So join us for that episode. Until then, this is the Movie Dude Eric.
And I'm Michelle Ely.
And Fiend.